You know, I do think being challenged is good. You know, I don't think it's necessarily good to not have challenges because I think you can get lazy. I'm trying not to get lazy. Mm-hmm. You know,
Judy Morgan's a Democrat who's represented part of Kansas City in the Missouri House since 2011. Her district? It's 83% Democratic. And last month on KCUR's political podcast, State House Blend Missouri, yeah, that's the other show I host, Morgan was discussing how this November, for the third election in a row, she won't face a Republican opponent.
You know, I'm out there still knocking doors, even though I'm running unopposed, putting out my yard signs, you know, doing all those things.
And why are you doing that?
Because I think you should interact with your constituents, and I think that's one of the ways you do it. You know, I mean, you obviously do it all year long through other ways, but I think getting out there and knocking doors, there's just really something to seeing somebody at their door and talking to them about their issues that is really important and is part of the democratic process. So, you know, I guess in a way we all kind of a sigh of relief. Well, we don't have to campaign, but yeah, I don't necessarily think it's a good thing.
Well, whether it's a good thing or not, unopposed elections, especially for the state legislatures in Kansas and Missouri, are fairly common. I'm Brian Ellison. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking about why that is and what impact it may be having on the candidates who run for office and on the communities they serve. We'll start by talking to a couple of those candidates who know a little about this. Luis Ruiz has represented some of the good people of Kansas City, Kansas, in the State House of Representatives since 2005. Representative Ruiz, good morning.
Good morning.
It's nice to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
This is your seventh time down this election road, so let me be the first to say congratulations on your reelection next month.
Thank you very much.
You don't have an opponent, so I know that outcome already. How did all this get started for you?
I was recruited to run back in 2004 by the person who was filling the seat in District 32 at the time. I had served on several boards around the city. Kansas City Public Television, I was on their community advisory board. I chaired that board, and then I was on their big corporate board and also on a national board for public television, the National Friends of Public Broadcasting. So they felt I was electable, so they recruited me to run for the seat.
And what does that mean that you were electable? What did they see in you?
I was a good community person involved. I'd been involved in union politics and worked on campaigns for Clinton, local campaigns for mayor, Congress, kind of visible in the community, and they knew that I would, you know, was community-minded and wanted to serve.
Was it something you'd always wanted to do?
Yes, I was. I chaired a legislative committee for my union and also for KCPT, and when I got to interact with the legislatures and some of the different levels of government, I thought that'd be something I'd really like to get involved with.
You thought, I could actually do this.
Exactly.
Did you think I could do this better than those guys?
Well, I could learn from them and maybe excel a tad.
Fair enough. So tell me about your district.
I served the 31st District of Wyandotte County, Kansas City, Kansas, and I've been serving that since 2012, the redistricting. A very, very eclectic, very diverse district, a lot of Latino Hispanics. We have Croatians, we have Hmong, Vietnamese, pretty good population of blacks, whites. My schools are very diverse. And it's kind of a hidden treasure, we feel, Wyandotte County, is just because of that demographics and the eclecticness of the cultures that are there.
How does that eclecticness, that diversity, affect how a person would campaign in that district?
Well, I being born in the district and being going to school in the district, I knew primarily the neighborhoods that I could walk into and feel comfortable in, and people kind of knew my family and myself. I was very welcome when I start walking the district. It wasn't difficult because Kansas City, Kansas is a primarily Democratic county.
Right. So you had a certain ideological kinship with a pretty solid majority of your district.
Correct.
And yet that doesn't mean that it comes naturally to want to go door to door, to want to talk to people. Do you feel like you're a natural campaigner?
It's an always learned objective. You know, people have certain talents that they're given, and one of mine is the gift of gab. My mom always told me, the teachers in school did. So I felt very comfortable interacting. You know, the old saying that nobody's a stranger kind of holds true on that level.
Was that a nice way of them saying that you talk too much?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So I guess I'm curious. You started running in 2004 when someone recruited you to do this. And I imagine at that time you weren't thinking a lot about the elections that would happen in 2006 and 2008. But I have to also wonder, did you ever say to yourself, you know, if I can just win this once, I'm probably set. I'm going to be able to get reelected again and again and again with hardly anyone opposing me.
That kind of held true when I was first elected. One of the firefighters came to me and says, you know, Lewis, at the seat you have and the strong base you have, you'll probably be there as long as you want to be. And that's when I first started thinking about it. And it's held true. I've only been opposed twice.
And was that an appealing part of seeking that office back in 2004?
I would say yes and no. Because once you get down there and you're in session and you're there like to 4 o'clock in the morning, you're like, why am I here? You know, one gentleman says, Lewis, did you already refile? I said, yep. Here you are. You're going to be here again. So, yeah.
Now, you did actually have opposition a couple of times along the way. How were those years different?
It motivates you to get out and be more visible. I still like to get out in my neighborhoods and be visible. But the impact is a little less strenuous now than it was then. People that didn't know you, you have to make a face. You have to sell yourself. When you campaign, you're selling a product, and that product is yourself.
Mm-hmm. And what is your sales pitch in a year when you don't have any opposition? I mean, what is it that you're selling then?
I'm selling the concept of we need a change in Kansas, and the only way we can bring a change is keep good people there and bring new people in, because if you see what's going on issue-wise, policy-wise, if you like what's going on, stay home or vote for the same way you have voted in the past. If you don't like it, get out, vote, and make a change.
And yet, it doesn't really matter to you and your ability to serve whether they get out and vote or not. You're going to, if as long as one person shows up to vote, you're going to be elected if you're unopposed. So how do you make a strong, compelling case that they need to get out there?
Well, with the small numbers we have in the Kansas House as Democrats, we need help down there because the last couple years has been the toughest years and sessions that I've been involved with. Anytime the governor wants something, he's got the supermajorities in the House and Senate, and so we need more people. That's the strength of the get out to vote.
Yeah. Do you feel like when you arrive in Topeka in those years after you've had an opponent, so you've actually beaten someone to get there, do you feel like you have more of a mandate, more of a charge from your constituents than in these years like this year where it's a walk?
Well, maybe, again, could it be answered both ways? Because you're there, the constituents feel you're doing a good job. You know, whomever hires you can fire you. People watch your votes. They know where you stand on certain issues, whether it be policy issues, social issues, or economic issues. You know, the Department of Transportation, there's issues go along there with our roads and how you vote along those lines. So at any time, people will call you up and confront you on your votes. It's challenging whether you have an opponent or not. Just your opponent is yourself and your constituencies. They hire you, they fire you.
So your opponent is yourself. What do you mean by that?
Well, you compete with your best self. You don't want to be a slacker because you know you're as good as your word, you're as good as your engagement, and people see that by your attendance, by your engagement, and how you react to the policymaking and what's going on in the legislature. So you're judged by that. I mean, you're constantly being under a magnifying glass.
So how have you been spending this campaign this year without an opponent? Are you actually going door to door? Are you doing the things that you would do otherwise?
I serve on, as an assistant House Minority Leader, I serve on a committee that helps fund different campaigns. And we go and we support people who we feel that can win an election. Money-wise, go door-to-door with them, support them, help them with their mailers.
So you're actually campaigning for other candidates. Yeah. And does that feel like that's a good use of your time? Is that something you enjoy doing?
Yes, I do. It's one of the things where we have good, strong people out there that we feel once they get engaged and once they start, hopefully they get elected after November, that they'll be able to make a difference.
Well, we want to talk more about that and about what kind of difference you think individual representatives can make, whether they are opposed or not. But let me first check in across the state line with Representative T.J. Barry. He's a Republican from Kearney, Missouri. He served in Jeff City since 2011. Welcome, Representative Barry.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been unopposed twice before. This year, you actually do have a third-party opponent, a Libertarian. But no Democrat has challenged you since you first won the seat. What do you take from that? Does that mean you're doing a great job?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Okay. But it means that people, to a large extent, trust you, that you're going to be direct with them, because we're always going to disagree. I disagree with my wife regularly, but that doesn't mean I don't trust her. And so if you're out in the community and you are talking to them and better listening to them, they know you care.
And so you take nobody filing against you for your reelection as a as an affirmation of the job that you're doing.
I do, because the bar to someone running against me is very, very low. It's $50 and a trip to Jefferson City. That's what it takes.
Let's step back and have you tell us a little bit about how you first got involved in politics. How did you get into this mess?
I said yes to a friend when he asked me to be his treasurer in a state representative race. And for 8 years, I was Representative Doug Irvin's treasurer. And at the end of his time, he came to me and he said, "You need to run for office." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because we need people that understand money to be involved in the process." So that's why I did it.
And you couldn't say no.
I almost said no. I thought about it long and hard.
Well, why was that such a difficult decision? Why wouldn't you instantly say yes to that?
The first question, I guess, is why are you wanting to run to begin with? Okay. And that you have to answer. And I thought, okay, I can help. I think that I can do a good job of bringing an objective and thoughtful way of going about governing. And once you've made that decision, then you can move forward with, yes, I'll go ahead and run.
Does the decision to go ahead and become a state representative come with a cost for you?
Guaranteed it comes with a cost. I've been a business owner since I was 20 years old. And I had a business when I started my first term and got down to Jefferson City, and the learning curve is extreme. And that first year, I was spending a strong 50 to 55 hours a week, Monday through Thursday, coming home and trying to run my business, putting in another 20 to 25 hours a week in that, just juggling all the balls. And at the end of my first term, I looked at my wife and I said, "We can't do this. I can't burn the candle at both ends like I did when I was 20. And I went ahead and sold my business at that point and have been a full-time legislator for the last 5 years. And it's allowed me to dig deep into some very complicated issues and try to make sense out of them.
Remind me, how much does a state representative get paid in Missouri?
They get paid right at $36,000 a year.
Now, that is not a very high salary.
No, it definitely is not.
So is that part of why some people may not be choosing to run for office in Missouri?
It may be. I don't know if that's the driving factor. You have multiple different types of people that run for office. You have the people that are ideologues, both on the Democrat side and on the Republican side. Both groups have ideologues that's why they're running, to push their point of view. Then you have many retired people, retired farmers, retired teachers that run, and they're at a different place in life. So wisdom that comes with those people is wonderful, but you don't necessarily get your 32-year-old person that has $80,000 worth of college debt still that is wanting to make a change for his community because the salary is so low.
Right. What's your district like that you represent in the House?
My district is a very competitive district, actually. It is, the demographics are about 53% Republican, 47% Democrat. And it's an interesting district in that part of it is suburban. Liberty, the community of Liberty, and Kearney, to a certain extent, is suburban. Mm-hmm. And then Excelsior Springs is also suburban, but it's the first rural suburban community.
Ex-urban, they sometimes say, right?
That's right. And so you got different, a little bit of different dynamics within just a very small geographic area.
It's a surprisingly ideologically split district for a place where a candidate has been unopposed so many times.
Yes.
Think back to your first election when you did have opponents. You had an opponent in the primary and in the general election back then. What was that like? How was that different?
You know, I compare it to starting a business in that when you start a business, you don't know the result. You create a plan, you start to execute the plan, and you make adjustments. Well, the difference between running for election and starting a business is you have a date certain of either success or failure.
Right. And then you know, and you won't have to decide again for at least 2 years.
That's right.
Were you afraid of losing? I mean, what would have been the consequences of you taking this risk and then not going to Jeff City?
You know, it's different. I think the first time when I was running in a primary, yeah, I was a little bit worried about losing. Today, if I had had a strong opponent and I ended up losing, I don't think I would have been nearly as bothered now as I would have been the first time.
And having been elected, having won that race back then, what was the impact of having won, having heard that affirmation in a closely fought battle once you got to Jeff City? Did that change how you served? Did you think about that once you were in the office?
Luckily, in that primary, it was interesting. The primary election was a hard-fought race between myself and a current representative now, Noel Scholl.
Mm-hmm.
But we never let it get personal. And because of that, he and I are very close friends. And that's the thing that you look at. Are you making the decisions for yourself, or are you making the decisions for your community? And as long as you're making the decisions for the community to the best of your ability, when you agree with people or disagree with people, you can sleep at night very easily.
So this year you aren't unopposed, but your opponent is a third-party candidate, Brian Lautenschlager, a Libertarian. How is it different to face a third-party candidate than a Democratic opponent?
So a Democratic opponent comes in with a base of support to begin with, that the people that are going to vote that way are going to vote that way. With a Libertarian, if he was a active candidate, which he hasn't been to this point, he starts at a pretty significant deficit. There isn't a natural base for him to work with.
Does it feel to you like you're running unopposed?
In many ways, in that he has not engaged in going to community functions. He hasn't chose not to raise any money. So yes, it does feel a lot like that.
So based on your experience, having experienced both having competition back in 2010 and not feeling like you have had it since, are you a better representative when you're elected in a contested race or when you can just walk into the office without the opposition?
I think it would depend on the attitude. So again, I brought up the first election primary, and the attitude between myself and my opponent was very congenial. But then in my next election in 2012, after redistricting, I had a Democrat in 2010, I had a Democrat in 2012. And in 2012, it was contentious. And, you know, in today's political environment, at our presidential level, it is very contentious. And I like to believe that no matter what, whether it's Democrat or Republican, the person that's running, especially the first time, is doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah, Representative Ruiz, I want to ask you the same question. You've seen both situations. Sometimes you've been opposed, sometimes you haven't. Do you feel like you are a better representative when you face opposition, or when you can focus your attention elsewhere and not have to face that competition on the way in?
I think the learning curve starts when that you gavel in when you first come into session. People can be as complacent as they want to be and reward themselves just because they're there. But every year you have to perform better because you're more experienced, you're more knowledgeable, and people depend on you more.
All right. Well, let's take a break. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll continue our conversation about running unopposed, even in an age of political divisiveness. Political science professor will break down the numbers for us and assess some of the underlying causes for all this, and we'll consider the impact on you. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about the reality of running unopposed. We've heard the experiences of two state legislators, Kansas Democrat Luis Ruiz and Missouri Republican T.J. Barry. They're still with us, but we're also joined now by Greg Vonami. He is not a legislator, but he knows a lot about them. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
It's great to have you here. Tell us about your work as a political science professor at UMKC. What do you spend most of your time working on?
My specialty is comparative state politics, so comparing the legislatures and politics across the states, and then public opinion and elections.
That's interesting. Why do you focus on state government when so much of the media and pundit attention gets focused on national issues?
I started my educational career studying world politics. I switched to state politics and some national politics because it was closer. The academic work was closer to the actual application of the policy, whereas that connection was more indirect and more remote from the academic work on world politics to the foreign policymakers.
Mm-hmm. How different is the political operation at the state level compared to at a federal level?
The functions of the federal government is very different from the state governments.
Right.
And then from there, the internal dynamics, there's a lot more institutional variation that's interesting at the state level that we don't see at the federal level.
So let's talk about then what you've learned by looking so closely at state governments and at state legislatures. Help us understand the scope of the situation we're talking about with these many unopposed races. How many are we talking about in Missouri and in Kansas?
Over the last 10 years, on average, about 57% of Missouri state legislative candidates, both for the House and the Senate, face any opponent.
Say that again. How many?
About 57%.
That seems really, really like a low number.
Slightly more than half face any opponent. The average is almost identical for Kansas. It's, again, about 57% over the last 10 years.
Wow. How does that compare to the rest of the country?
Missouri and Kansas are both about average. The highest that we see, Michigan has 98% contestation, so almost all of their candidates face an opponent. The lowest is Arkansas, which is about only a third of their candidates face any opponent.
Now, sometimes an interviewer asks questions they already know the answer to, and I'm about to do that. I'm just going to warn you. I asked Representative Barry a minute ago if not drawing an opponent meant that he was doing a great job. Is that what that means, that everyone across the country more than half the time thinks that their legislator is doing a great job?
I'd say about a quarter of the time. That's probably the case.
Okay.
There are several causes of uncontested races, but certainly one of those is an incumbent that's very strong, that's maintained the trust and confidence of their constituents.
So that is sometimes the case. What are some of the other cases?
The other case is if we begin to look at the structure of the legislatures and their elections, one of the factors that matters is the pattern of districts. A lot of states create heavily Democratic and heavily Republican districts where a Democrat or Republican wouldn't be competitive in a particular district.
Well, say more about that. Is that gerrymandering pure and simple? Is that a political agenda being played out, or does that just sort of happen?
Part of it is it just happens, and it happens more for Democrats than Republicans.
Why is that?
Democrats they draw more of their support from cities where there are heavily concentrated populations. So Democrats have sort of a natural gerrymander that Republicans don't have. Republicans tend to hold majorities in relatively more competitive, relatively more mixed districts, apart from any kind of institutional redistricting or any attempt to create a partisan advantage.
So that seems like maybe we see that here in the Kansas City metro area, probably on both sides of the state line. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
We mentioned Judy Morgan. We heard her at the top of the hour has represented an 83% Democratic district. We even have a district here, actually neighbors Judy Morgan's district, that will be where Jeremy Lefevre is the representative, and he'll be succeeded by in an open seat election by Greg Razor, who is running unopposed as a Democrat for an open seat, which just seems quite remarkable. Is that all that uncommon?
No. Most of the states have some type of partisan redistricting process. It's a little bit different in Kansas and Missouri. In Kansas, the legislature does redistricting. In Missouri, they appoint a commission to do it, so the legislature isn't directly responsible, but that commission is a partisan commission.
So you mentioned the district, the way districts are drawn is one reason. There are other reasons why so many of these seats end up unopposed?
Two others are campaign finance. So studies have shown that the more state campaign finance restrictions there are, and for state candidates, they're governed by state laws, not federal law. So it's up to the states to regulate campaign finance how they want.
Let me stop you there. I mean, what does that mean? Why would the way finance is regulated affect who challenges whom for office. They're all playing by the same rules, right?
There are arguments on both sides, whether or not having more campaign finance restrictions or less increases or decreases candidate competition. The weight of the evidence is that the more restrictions that are in place, the more candidates that you tend to see emerging in state legislative races.
So Missouri almost leads the country in not having limitations on campaign finance. Does that affect then, is that part of why there are so few opposed races?
Missouri is one of about a dozen states that has very few restrictions on the amounts or sources of campaign money.
Is it different in Kansas? Do we see a different result as a result of Kansas having some limitations on campaign contributions?
Well, their level of contestation is similar in terms of candidates. If we look at candidate competition, so we can also ask the question, does a candidate face a serious challenger? And there we actually do see more Kansas representatives facing serious challengers than we do in Missouri.
And Greg, is the reason that the finance rules affect contestation rates that incumbents have an easier time raising funds and they can raise so many more funds that nobody wants to challenge them? Is that the logic there?
Yes. And when people have studied potential challengers, one of the things that puts off a lot of potential challengers is they don't have to fundraise. They don't have to dial for dollars.
Which is pretty much part of the job these days.
Yes. And the more money that incumbents tend to raise, the higher the barrier is for challengers.
I will say I watched both of our state representatives at the table nod their head when I said that's part of the job these days. That is part of what happens. Okay. You mentioned there's a fourth reason. What's the other factor in why there are so few races with opposition?
There are about 20 states that have state legislative term limits, and here's where we see a difference between Missouri and Kansas. Missouri has legislative term limits. Kansas does not. Term limits have two effects on contestation. One is it gives challengers an incentive to wait till there's an open seat, so they won't run against an incumbent if they know that incumbent has to leave in 2 years or 4 years. The other thing it does is it relatively devalues the seat. So if a potential candidate is looking at it and say, well, I can only get 8 years in the legislature, they may decide to get involved in politics in some other way.
That's interesting. I'm going to actually stop there and ask our two guests at the table who represent two different states. T.J. Berry from Missouri, did you think twice about filing for a seat knowing that you would only have 8 years to serve in the House?
No, I did not.
Is 8 years, does that feel like enough to serve in the House?
I think it's plenty. I am a proponent of term limits because of the enthusiasm that the next person will bring to the job. It takes a certain individual that really wants to run for office, and hopefully for the right reasons, to be involved. And they come in that first year, and they are full of vigor and ready to go. And that's a positive thing. Yes, you lose institutional knowledge, and I have a lot of depth of knowledge in the utility, but I think that enthusiasm is worth something.
Do you think you've benefited from, as Greg was explaining, the fact that a person might choose not to challenge you this year, knowing that your seat will be open in 2 years? They don't have to. They might as well wait until they have a much better shot at it.
I think that most definitely plays into the system. I don't know if it does in my specific spot, but it does in many, and it could in mine also.
Now, over on the Kansas side, though, Luis Ruiz, you have been you're running for your seventh term. So, do you feel like that has had an impact on the likelihood of someone filing against you, your longevity in the office?
That's one of the reasons. Also, they look at your voting records and your constituencies, and like that was discussed prior, your war chest, we call it, the money that you have in your campaign.
Because you just roll it over year after year if you're not spending it.
Correct. But getting back to what you were talking about as far as term limits, 8 years is a good round number for term limits. But the learning process down in the legislature, you start out as a committee member, then you can work your way up to a vice chair or chair, and that could be 8 years. By the time you get to that experience like TJ, he's a chair, then he's going to be gone. So he's going to take that institutional knowledge with his chairmanship with him. We lose a lot of experience. We'll lose a lot of that if we had term limits in Kansas. Now, Missouri is maybe have a different philosophy, but my philosophy is that if you look at the way you go to school, there's certain amounts of years that you take as a learning process. Then you reach a plateau, then you learn some more. And in Kansas, because we do not have term limits, you carry that experience on, you get more knowledge. To me, I think it's an asset.
Yeah.
It has more value.
Yeah. Representative Barry?
You know, if I could change one thing about Missouri's term limit laws, we have 8 years in the House, and then if a person chooses, you can do 8 years in the Senate if you're elected to that. It would be nice that if they had just made it 16 years total, and you would have gotten a little bit more depth of knowledge.
I think some states do that, right?
Yes.
You've both mentioned money, Representative Ruiz. You mentioned the war chest. How big a factor is money in all of this? Do you amass, as you said, a war chest in order to ward off competition? Is that part of why you would raise money, even if you don't feel like you're going to face a serious threat? It's to make sure you don't. Is that a fair assessment, TJ?
It's a partial assessment, but money is only one piece of the puzzle. Okay, because my first election, my opponent had more money than I did. But I got out there and really talked to the community, knocked on doors. I knocked on 5,000 doors in a little over 2.5 months for the primary, and then I knocked on another 5,000 doors for the general. So people knew who I was by the end of that process. And on my... on all of my literature, okay, that I hand people at the door, which I'm doing currently even though I'm unopposed, is my cell phone. And I say, don't call me between 6 and 7:30 dinner time. Be reasonable. Treat me like you would want to be treated. But people know that they can get a hold of me and that I will answer my phone call.
Yeah. And Lewis, you one of the ways you can use a war chest, as you say, is to help other candidates, which then increases your stature and then gives your district, your constituents, more reason to support you and keep you there.
Now, when you have your campaign funds, you can't donate to them. You can donate to your, like, the Kansas for a Democratic House, and they can disseminate the money down.
So it's an indirect way of supporting
other
candidates.
And one thing that we look at, being on the committee that I serve on, the election committee for the Kansas House, we look at our opponents, what they have in the bank, to see that kind of shows their strength as well. And that way we know, kind of get a monetary value, what it's going to cost to get mailers out, get door-to-door pamphlets out, those type of things. And then we decide if the candidate, we ask them to work hard, and then we'll work hard with them.
I want to invite our listeners into the conversation. We do want to hear from you. What do you make of all this? And I want to hear, especially if you're a Democrat in Liberty, let's say, or a Republican in Kansas City, Kansas, what do you do when there's no one of your party even running for the state house? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet your comments to KCURCST. Greg Venami of the UMKC Political Science Department, you're hearing these representatives talk about some of the factors that they think have been why they have not been challenged more frequently for office. Do their experiences hold up with what you've seen around both states?
One thing I'd say about the issue of campaign money is it tends to be very skewed across candidates. If you look at the distribution of resources, we see some candidates raise an exorbitant amount of money. I think in a recent election in Missouri, and this is typical of other states, I think the top 10% of candidates raised about 60% of the total campaign fund. So it varies a lot from district to district.
And why is that?
One of the best predictors of raising campaign money is how much campaign money you've raised before. If we see a candidate raising a lot of money, they just tend to expand on that advantage over time.
Is it harder to raise money when you're unopposed? I mean, do unopposed candidates raise money at the same level as those who have a tough battle?
Yes and no. On the one hand, it's more attractive for donors to give to a candidate in a competitive race. But on the other hand, it's like Lewis said, candidates that already have a lot of money can also deter other candidates from emerging.
I have to think, T.J. Barry, it's hard to approach a potential donor and ask for a few thousand dollars to beat your non-existent opponent.
You have to remember that, and sometimes people are giving you money because they know you're a sure bet. Okay, you are going to be elected, and so they give you money because of that also.
I see. And what do you think, Lewis? Have you had any trouble raising money, more trouble in the years that you were not facing an opponent?
Well, right now in Kansas, because we have such high competitive races and with people really looking at a turnover, in our state government, House and Senate, a lot of that money is being flown to strong candidates that are going hopefully to unseat some of the incumbents. So I get money, but not as much as I would on an off year.
Let's take one more break. We want you to let us know what you think about how having so many unopposed races affects our politics and our communities. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. 235-2888. Tell us why you think it matters whether there's opposition in these races. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll continue the conversation on KCUR Central Standard in just a moment. There's some hotly contested races on everyone's ballot this year, from the presidential election on down, but in many places around Kansas and Missouri, your representation in the state house may already be determined, with only one name for you to choose. We're talking about unopposed elections today on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. I'm here with Greg Vanami of UMKC's Political Science Department, Missouri Representative T.J. Berry of Kearney, and Kansas Representative Luis Ruiz of Kansas City, Kansas. I want to talk about the impact of all of this on the governing that happens in Jefferson City or in Topeka, and on the policies that emerge and affect us all. When we have so many candidates elected without opposition, representing not necessarily the full breadth of a competitive district, but rather just the folks that they had to appeal to win their primaries, let's say, does that change the nature of the discourse that happens in the Capitol? Does it change the kind of laws that get passed in the Capitol? Luis, you are one of, not quite a handful, but a small number of Democrats in the Kansas House.
And that holds true. After the primaries in Kansas, we saw a shift to the middle, and we saw a lot of the people who were very ultra-conservative, very far to the right, get defeated. People have already started to change their attitudes in Topeka by wanting to introduce new laws after first of the year when we first start session. And case in point is the Medicaid expansion. They're going to take a little harder look at that than they have in the past, because now they're looking at, if they don't start at least dialoguing about that, they won't be there after the general. So,
and a lot of the competition on the Kansas side this year, of course, has come at the primary level, especially in Republican primaries.
That's correct.
That will have a big impact on what happens next year in Topeka. T.J. Berry, do you see differences in the kind of legislation that's passed in Jeff City because so many people are elected without competition?
No, I don't believe that I do. What I do see is people that maybe not be listening quite as well. I was elected by X number of percent of my party, whether that's Republican or Democrat, so I'm not going to listen as closely to the opposition.
They're accountable.
I think that that happens, but I don't think that you govern differently.
Is there research about this, Greg Vanami?
Yes, and it depends on two factors. So one, having a low level of general election competitiveness can contribute to polarization between the parties if that shifts the locus of competition to primary elections. Mm-hmm. That can drive a bigger wedge between the parties.
Which is something we've seen in Kansas this year.
Right.
Right.
If there's both a low level of competition in the primary and general elections, then the effect tends to be to localize politics. There's relatively less attention to statewide issues and more attention to district issues.
And I know you're just giving us the research about this, but is that a positive or a negative development? Can you assess that? I mean, is it so bad for attention to be localized?
There are advantages and disadvantages to both. The advantage of having localized politics is it allows a community or a district to tailor policies and programs towards what that community wants. On the other hand, that might not be efficient or optimal from the perspective of a larger statewide community.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. Let's talk to Kelly, who lives in KCK. Good morning, Kelly.
Hi, good morning.
What are your thoughts this morning about unopposed elections?
Yes, well, I of course agree with much of what has been said, but I think that one of the points that really needs to be highlighted is that sometimes an elected official runs unopposed because his constituency really likes him or her. That person really does the work of their constituency. I live in Representative Ruiz's district, And I think that is a true statement about Representative Ruiz. He is a measured elected official. He is thoughtful. He is not radical. And as was just mentioned by Representative Ruiz, we have so many ultra-conservatives in our state house. We need that measured, thoughtful person who you know, brings reason to the conversation.
Okay.
And Representative Ruiz has always done that. I think, by and large, that's why he runs unopposed. He's very popular in his district.
Well, I appreciate that, Kelly. Thank you so much for the call. And we heard that from Representative Barry earlier, and from our political science professor guest, Greg Venami, that some percentage of races tend to be unopposed because people are genuinely satisfied with the candidate. But Representative Ruiz, let me ask you. I mean, one of the problems that a lot of people have noted is that voter turnout seems to sometimes be down. Wyandotte County has seen a pretty steep decline in voter turnout over the last few elections. Do you think that's a real consequence of there not being more competition for some of these seats in the legislature?
As we look at the election cycle in off years, it holds true. I think there's a lot of complacency and a little apathy with some of the voters, especially some of the inner city people. They don't see a different change unless they at different levels of government, unless people there's a drastic turnaround on elected officials. They may see something, but I don't know if they really anticipate that they want to be part of it or just a result of it.
That's interesting. So do you feel like people are expressing uncertainty about their role in the political process by simply not showing up to vote? Is that what you're saying?
I think so, and probably they feel they don't have a role. And it's up to us as elected officials and people who are involved in campaigns to get that strong message out that you are part of the electorate, you are important.
We've been talking about whether the candidates who get elected in unopposed elections are somehow less engaged, but do you worry about the impact on voters who do not have to think about their state legislative race because there's no competition on the ballot? TJ Barry?
You know, this year is a polarizing election, and it's at the national level, and people, for better or worse, focus on the national level rather than focusing on the local district level. And so we sometimes get lost in a presidential year, and it makes it very, very hard for people to discern the person, okay, rather than the tribe. And that's where I think we have a real problem today, is that we divide in tribes, the Republican tribe, the Democrat tribe, when thoughtful thinking should be part of the process in solving problems. Because the problems, we all can see, they're glaring. It's how do you come about the solutions?
Greg Venami, are there other consequences that you see from your research to having this high level of unopposed elections?
Well, as it relates to turnout, the top of the ticket races in a presidential election year, it'll be the presidential election. In a congressional election, it'll usually be a senator or governor's race, mm-hmm. will primarily drive turnout. For what down-ballot candidates can do, a lot of that will be driven by campaigning. So one of the most effective ways of mobilizing voters is door-to-door canvassing. And it sounds like our candidates, even when they're unopposed, frequently still engage in that level of door-to-door canvassing.
And is that common, do you think? Are these two representatives, or you think that's maybe less common?
I like to think it's common. It'll probably vary by district. People who represent very remote districts, for example, probably aren't doing as much door-to-door canvassing just because of the nature of the district. And it also probably varies a lot by who that representative is.
Representative Barry mentioned polarization, that this is a polarizing election. Do you feel like state politics are becoming more polarized?
That depends a lot on the state. Missouri has shown a higher level of it also depends on what you mean by polarization. If we mean legislative polarization, Missouri has trended towards more legislative polarization, where it's now close to Congress in terms of its level of party polarization on a variety of different metrics. Kansas has sort of been an outlier in that it hasn't polarized as much, except for maybe very recent sessions. I don't have the numbers on those, but for a long time, Kansas has persisted as a less polarized outlier.
Let's talk to Mark in Prairie Village. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
So how do you feel like unopposed races are affecting your community?
Well,
Okay, so a couple of things. That's actually not the reason I called. I called with a question. The way it's affecting the community is everybody I know is just registering Republican, regardless of which party they're in, so that they can vote in the primary, which is where the real election is. But my question is, I was very shocked by somebody who's there who said that some people are more likely to give to me when they know I'm definitely going to win because I'm running unopposed, which for all intents and purposes sounds to me like what they're saying is, well, you know, I need something, and I'm for 100% certain this guy's going to be in office, so I better give him some money till I'll get what I need once he's elected, which, in other words, sounds like a bribe, and I don't understand why somebody would talk about that or how that works. It's very strange.
That's a fair question, Mark, and I appreciate your calling in with it. Both of our candidates sitting here actually have leadership roles in their respective caucuses or their respective houses of service. T.J. Barry, you're chair of the Utilities Committee in the Missouri House. When you're receiving contributions going into an unopposed election, our caller Mark says, "Gosh, that sounds like that might be something like a bribe." Is that how that feels to you?
Not at all. Not even remotely close. In that, I've been a business owner all of my life, and part of the things that I do are sales. And the first rule of sales is you have to ask for it. If you don't ask for a sale, you're never going to get it. Okay? And so when you take that kind of philosophy to campaign finance, you ask people, do you like me? Do you like what I've done? Do you, I've represented you. Can you support me? Because that money, Luis said something that's very accurate. I may not use the money for myself, but I most definitely will use it for other people that are in competitive races. And that happens both parties all the time.
Yeah. Luis Ruiz, you're the assistant minority leader in the Kansas House. Do you feel like that has allowed you to raise more money in these years when you're unopposed, and should it?
Well, it's a matter of opinion. If your war chest, the visibility of what you have in your campaign account stems off potential opponents. But in my case, I would just as soon have the people who want to donate to the candidates that have a strong race and can use the money a lot more than I can.
Yeah. And do you feel, I mean, taking that from the other side of that coin, do you feel like one reason you've become a leader in your party is that you seem to be serving in a fairly safe seat? You have been able to establish some credibility around the idea that you're going to be there for a while.
Correct.
And that's given you more influence.
Right.
I'll speak on that real quick. Yeah. In that, so when I started, Missouri has term limits. You have 8 years. You've got to decide your path, your plan. What do you want to do? And I thought about running for leadership. And then redistricting happened in 2011. And I went from a 60% Republican district down to a 52.5% Republican district. And at that point, it's a very competitive district.
You knew you wouldn't be the House Speaker anymore.
That's right. You knew that that path is not there. And that was okay. I dug in and started learning about my subject of expertise, and it's been a very good thing.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests today. That's Representative T.J. Barry. He's a Republican from Kearney in the Missouri House of Representatives. And Representative Luis Ruiz, who is in the Kansas House representing KCK, a Democrat. Thanks to both of you.
My pleasure.
And also Greg Vanami, who is a political science professor at UMKC. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you can find this program online. We'll post it later this afternoon. You can also find all our other recent shows there. We're at kcur.org/centralstandard. We also use Twitter to keep you up to speed on the show and the topics that we follow. Follow us at kcurcst. You can follow me personally. I'm at ptsbryan. Join us tomorrow. We'll have an exit interview with the managing editor of The Pitch. We'll also take a look at beatmaking in Kansas City, plus the latest edition of Question Quest. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our team includes Suzanne Hogan, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, along with intern Raven Brooks. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you tomorrow.